Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another fine episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. Didn't do one last week. I mean, you guys have noticed that the schedule is getting pretty effing sporadic. Last week, I had the plague, and I kind of couldn't talk. The wife and I got the old COVID, so everyone's okay, but it sucked.
Yeah, you feeling better? You look good?
I feel fine. I tested positive again yesterday, so I'm just kind of waiting for the fucking cooties to be gone from me. So we'll see how all this plays out.
Like that old Stevie Wonder song, I just called to say I tested positive.
Why do I get the idea that joke didn't used to be about COVID?
That's so an old joke.
I just want to go back to work and get some money. Like, not working is great and all, but like, you don't get paid when you don't work. At least I don't get paid when I don't work. And
yeah, that's usually how that happens.
And so I'm down a week of income and counting. So I'm gonna need this positive test to hurry up and goddamn materialize. I mean, obviously, by the time this hits the airwaves, everything will be over because it's just lingering a couple of days. But it's been obnoxious.
Yeah.
And as a result,
did you lose your sense of taste?
No, sense of taste was fine. Got a really nasty fever for a couple of days and just felt like absolute crap. No energy, and I mean that's just normal. But like there was a fever on top of it, and then a lot.
You
of
know what else does that? Natty ice.
It's actually Bud Ice today. It's funny you should say that.
Oh, you got a Bud Ice.
I got a tall boy. I got some proper wine in the freezer, but it's not cold yet. And Mr. Deuce, it's actually not even a Deuce Deuce. It's a Deuce Cinco, a 25
really?
Ounce. Yeah. Just a little bit more than two cans. You know, just getting
$1.99.
Something like that. got myself a tall boy. We're doing this.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I told you this, but around Christmas time, I was talking with Mrs. Dog, and she really wanted to, like, make, like, a family calendar, you know, and, like, the you know, like, Shutterfly and all that,
yeah.
Where you can, like, take pictures. And I knew she'd never do it. And she went months and months, and I told her, I go, okay, you got 2 weeks to get a calendar ordered, or I'm ordering a calendar, and you will not like what I choose. So, of course, she didn't do it. And so I ordered scenic dog shits, dogs taking shits in scenic views. And my kids love it. Every month, it's like the dog shit of the month. They're thrilled with that.
You know, what's
so that's
funny,
kind of cool.
That is pretty cool. My wife.
Not really much to do with food, but you know,
my wife
had a good laugh about that.
My wife and her, my wife and her mother both got each other dog calendars, like Shutterfly style, like homemade dog calendars. Like they got each other the same gift for Christmas. It was ridiculous, but mother-in-law's was inferior in one way, and that is that it did not have a month of a collage of the dog shitting. So.
Yeah, there's lots of grumpy faces and double tails and
oh yeah there's definitely some excellent dogs shitting calendar art going on. It was last month, so it was April. For some reason, April was the month of shitting dogs. So this month it's actually just like dogs playing with toys or something, and it's honestly kind of a letdown. Every time I look at my calendar, I'm like, it's okay, but it could be dog shitting.
Yeah, we were slapping each other up. We got to flip the calendar the other day. Like, yeah, dog shit of the month. Woo.
But what's funny is that I now have, because of course my wife made herself one along with the one that she made her mom. So we now have dog calendars, different calendars of the same dogs in different rooms at our house, which is already funny because like, one commodity that I no longer need any more of is pictures of that goddamn dog.
Well, this isn't even our dog.
Right. It's the same dog I look at every damn day. And then every time I look at the calendar, there's more of that dog.
It's the little things.
She's a decently photogenic dog.
Yeah, I haven't been up to too much is what I'm trying to tell you.
Me either. Well, I mean, like I said, I had Corona, so I feel like that's kind of my excuse for not doing anything the last 10 days, but I didn't really want to do anything.
Still messing around with that mesophilic, cheese culture. I made some creme fraiche with it. It's really
Ooh,
good, man.
Cool. Did you start with, okay, so did you
just
culture
cream and this in the culture?
So you
heat it to like 85 and then sprinkle in it was like 250 grams of cream and like 0.4 grams of the mesophilic Floridanica starter culture.
Where are you getting this stuff, man?
I got it from Amazon.
Awesome. Dude, you can get anything
Floridanica is the brand you want.
Let me ask you this. Are you starting with like pasteurized, like grocery store cream?
Yep.
Okay, so you could like regular ass cream, like this regular cream.
Yeah, it's not as good like that ultra high heat pasteurized, but honestly, who can find better cream? And
I don't know, man.
Like $20 a quart.
Right. I mean, like I know Celeste does her buttermilk, but I don't even know if she does cream.
I don't think so. I know she does the raw milk, which would probably work, but.
But the thing is, I think that the thing is she doesn't produce cream probably because she leaves it in the raw milk. Like,
right. I don't think she does. Yeah. She just keeps it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so I, you're right. I don't know where to find fancy ass cream in our market, but it's cool that
just
it works.
Tinkering, like, you know,
tinkering is good.
Me.
Speaking of tinkering, I failed in my mission. I did not do the Briat Savarin cherry pop tart, cherry toaster strudel test yet.
I haven't either. I gotta get some Briat Savarin.
I was editing the last podcast and I was all gung ho. I was like, I'm definitely doing this before our next taping. And then, to be honest, I didn't remember that until I was editing it. And I was like, well, that didn't happen. And then I was like, oh, well, tomorrow we'll go to the grocery store. And then, bam, got the virus. And I was like, well, that's not going to happen. So,
well, speaking of grilled cheese, your grilled cheese blog post struck quite the chord in a positive way.
Oh, really?
We got a lot of responses and like people were like, what kind of cheese? Like they were like some grilled cheese aficionados out there. So my hat's off to you. And that looked awesome.
I told you, I mean, you read the story, right? I found this.
Oh,
I found,
yeah, it was great.
I just, you know, you ever find a random recipe in your notes? And I was like, well, it's not metric. So I'm positive it's not Nate's. And I've heard of all the ingredients. So I know it's not Tarver's. I actually texted Jordan and he's like, that sounds like something I'd make, but that wasn't me. So I have no idea where I got this recipe, but I figured after the Frico grilled cheese and that, I feel like doing next level grilled cheeses is something that I can put
on
the blog.
Did you toast both sides of the bread? Is that where we
did
we talk about doing that? Or is that something that I didn't?
Well, that's not a trick I remember. I think, I've done it, but this was not that.
I want to say Tarver mentioned to do that.
Maybe he did.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, the point is there's just no, the beauty of grilled cheese is that none of the components are particularly expensive. Like, yes, cheese gets expensive, but no matter how expensive a piece of cheese you're using, you're not going to make a toasted cheese sandwich where the cheese costs more than $7 or $8. Unless you really make a gigantic toasted cheese sandwich using like Beaufort or something that's like $44 a pound. But even then you can make a pretty, like, you're just not going to break the bank with a grilled cheese. So I feel like that's one of those recipes that you can really kind of go nuts on.
We may have already talked about this too, but I tell you about that grilled cheese food truck, that guy who only sells $1 grilled cheese. That's it. And he's got all this banter all over the outside of his, I don't know where in America this is.
I have read about this guy.
He's like, no, Karen, you cannot have a half a grilled cheese. No, I do not have change. No, I only accept cash. No, I don't have any napkins. I have dollar grilled cheese sandwiches. Like he's such an ass, but it's brilliant.
It's almost like performance art. I'll put, like, I read
how many
something
do you want? 1, 10? I don't care. They're $1.
I love
no,
it.
The bread is an artisan. No, I'm not even sure it's cheese.
I read about that somewhere. I'm not sure it was you that turned me on.
We gotta find that guy.
Yeah, no, that's
cracks me up.
It kind of reminds me of do you ever see the movie I Like to Kill Flies?
No, but it reminds me of that guy in Brooklyn you told me about with the huge diner
movie.
Menu.
Yeah, Kitty Shopson.
That's him?
Yeah, I Like to Kill Flies. I Like to Kill Flies is a documentary about that guy.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And then, well, then there's the book.
Whoa, creepy.
Kenny Shopson's book. Oh, it's fantastic. Like,
Kenny Shopson. That's it.
I love that guy. He's like, we have 900 items on our menu. If you don't like one of them, get something else. There's no substitutions. You can find something you want with 900 items on our menu.
Yeah. Come on, man.
No, I like that guy. He's cool, man. Like, and then he talks about in his book, he goes through like all the different things he does to like make his restaurant a success. Like, he wants everything to cook faster, so he bored out the burners on his gas stove.
to open them up to like get more gas line into it, or air?
To run bigger flames. He bored them out like he's souping up a 60s Chevelle.
That's so not how that works.
I mean, it's probably stupidly dangerous.
That is not even how that works. What an idiot. That's stupid, man.
You can bore holes over, man. You can get greater flow.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. What do I know?
I mean, the thing is, I think that there's those, I don't know. I mean, there's probably something that the stovetop does to like limit. I don't know. I don't get it.
Sounds like he may have voided the warranty.
Oh, absolutely. And probably voided the fire suppression. I mean, like this.
The fire marshal is not a fan of him.
The fire marshal. You guys got to read this book. I'll put a link to it on the blog. It's this diner owner in Brooklyn somewhere in New York. And he just has this like little hole in the wall diner. I think the guy's actually died now, and his kids took over the business or something. I don't know. I lost track of him. One of my favorite cookbooks. You don't actually learn how to make anything really when you read it, but you get a really great picture of just an eccentric sort of blue collar restaurant guy. And he's like, you know, you can learn a lot from reading like the great Michelin star guys like Paul Bocuse and Fernand Pointe, or you can learn a lot by reading like the great American entrepreneurs like Paul Bertoli or Alice Waters or Thomas Keller. But you could also learn a lot by just reading the food and philosophy of this crazy diner cook who cooks at a grungy little hole in the wall that has 900 things on the menu. Like,
yeah, he'll draw a line right in the sand and don't you dare cross it.
I read a piece about him in the New Yorker maybe 25 years ago.
When Bourdain was coming around.
Something around. It was post Bourdain, and this is I don't read the New Yorker, but my grandparents did.
I don't.
And
my monocle.
Yeah, I read like wrestling trade sheets.
Yeah, I don't read that either.
And food mags, but somebody saved the article. They cut it out and for me. Like someone read it and was like, "Give this to Jesse." I read it. And I was like, this guy's awesome. Then he had a book and he had a documentary. So everybody watch the documentary. I Like to Kill Flies.
I gotta watch that. I got like, some homework.
It's like an hour. It's a good hour. It's a fun way to kill an hour as you just watch this crazy old coot. Just like he's so awesome. Like he doesn't serve people with allergies. He's like, you have an allergy, go into the hospital. I don't want to be responsible for your life or death situation.
Exactly. You must be this tall to ride the ride. Sorry. Yeah,
like, you don't want to eat here? That's not my problem. Go away.
Go away.
He's like,
I am not responsible for you.
He's what we all wish we could be.
Yep.
Well, at any rate, that was my long way of coming around to I did not get my grilled cheese experiment done. My grilled cheese using Pop-Tarts as bread, but it's gonna happen. Or toaster strudels. We're gonna have an objective taste test. Although so far everyone has been pro toaster strudel and anti Pop-Tart. So
as they should.
That has been the consensus so far. For those of you who didn't listen to the last episode, we got into an argument over what would make a better bread for a novelty grilled cheese using Brie Savarin cheese, a cherry toaster strudel or a cherry Pop-Tart. And I am the lone holdout for the Pop-Tart. Everyone else is behind the toaster strudel. These are the
important... Me and my brother got in more fist fights over toaster strudels than I can ever begin to tell you.
You reenacted a few on the last episode. I believe.
Oh, I did.
Phrase.
Okay.
You used 6 packets of frosting for one strudel.
You monster.
Which does seem like something that Adam would do.
Okay. I did bring that up.
Oh yeah,
and we pounded each other over those things.
So yeah.
Anyways,
I like how your kids refer to your to Adam as Uncle Buck. Because Dee had an online job recently. She didn't end up sticking with it, but she was doing a meet and greet with some of the people that she was going to be working with, and they were making small talk, and someone asked what her husband was like, and she's like, have you seen Uncle Buck? He's pretty much Uncle Buck.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, god damn it.
Oh, he's a lovable guy.
All right, well, for starters, we have a listener question. From Mr. Jonathan Huff of some terrible little hamlet in rural Georgia. I can't remember exactly where it's the you know
I know where it is, but I'm gonna go with that description.
It's just like 16 peach trees, 15 churches, 14 bars, and a gas station. One of those towns. But
and full of pecan shells.
Jonathan is a man of culture. Never mind where he lives. He kicked us this topic. He wanted to know what it takes to get us to send something back at a restaurant. And he said that in his world, he has to think something's going to make him sick before he'll send it back.
I'm right about at that threshold. I've been thinking about that. Like, that's about my threshold. If I think it's going to get me sick or my family sick, it's going back. Or if it's just basically inedible, I'm not paying for that. Like, come on.
I have really.
It's got to be bad.
It's funny because like guys like you and I have such high standards, but I won't do it. I never sent anything back.
I never do it. I don't think I ever have. But I'll tell you what, I may not send it back, but I will never go back. And telling everybody.
Oh yeah. I'm trying to think I had to think about that. I was like, when have I sent something back?
I don't remember ever doing that.
I thought of one time. I can remember one time ever where I sent something back. And the reason I remember is because there's only one. It just doesn't happen. So the one jumped out at me. I was at Superior Grill, which is like a fajita place in New Orleans. And it's like a local Louisiana chain. Like, I think it started in Shreveport, which is out west. It's good fajitas. I mean, it's like just a regular fajita place. But the dish I liked was the tacos al carbon, which means tacos from the grill. Like taco carbon, just like charcoal. And it was just steak tips, like not a whole steak. I mean, I was making like $8 an hour and going to school full time. So like the fajita plate was like a, $25 entree, but for like $12.99, you get like a 3-pack of tacos with steak tips in there. And it was not quite as much food, but it was a little more affordable. It was about the nicest lunch that I could afford on my horrible, horrible New Orleans, like line cook salary. Right. And so that was like my version of a fancy restaurant. Like, we'd go someplace every couple of months and like really like go someplace kind of nice, but like this would be the money that I was making back then. Tacos al carbon was like the nicest. Like, that was like, okay, we can afford to go to Superior Grill once this month, because at every other meal we're like, eating, just peanut butter sandwiches and
But it was good, but you could still fill up for a reasonable price.
Yeah, it was good. And so I went there, I ordered the tacos al carbon, and I could totally see what happened. They brought me a taco salad. So she heard tacos al carbon, taco sal, and she just messed up the last syllable. But I hate taco salad with an explosive passion. I think it's the stupidest dish in the history of the world. I was like, I did not order this. And she's like, yes, you did. I was like, I really didn't. Like, I promise you, there's no way in a million years that I would ever order a taco salad. I said taco sal carbone. And she's like, oh, and like rolled her eyes at me. And I'm like, if somebody is hemming and hawing between two menu items, or if you have two things that sound kind of the same, I'm not going to be a jerk about it. But I had so little money. And like, that was like, I really needed to make that work. I did not need a big bowl of lettuce with ground up taco meat on it. I hate taco salad. It's one of my least favorite dishes. It should be disinvented. Although I do like the beer commercial where the Budweiser guy's like, this one's for you, taco salad inventor.
That was a great, that was a great ad campaign.
2 pounds of meat, cheese, and sour cream. And if there's room left over, some lettuce. Okay, that was funny.
But is it healthy, you ask? It's a salad, isn't it?
those were the best beer commercials ever.
Those are awesome.
But they didn't make me switch to Budweiser. I mean, I've drank plenty of Budweisers in my day, but it wasn't because of those commercials. But man, those were the best beer commercials. But I hate taco salad. I will never order a taco salad. So she brought me a dish I hated, and then was snarky with me when I said it's not what I ordered. So I sat there and waited, and I was almost late for work because this is like a pre-work lunch thing. But I got my tacos al carbon just because it wasn't even close. Like, if you put cheese on a burger and I said no cheese, whatever, water under the bridge, I don't care. If I asked for my burger to be like medium and it's well, I'm not going to get mad. I don't get mad. There's no point. Like, it, I may, you know, think, well, that wasn't up to my standards. And then if something pisses me off, I'll tell a million people about it, but I won't send something back. But yeah, that's what it took. It took coming out and it being a dish that I completely just could not deal with. Like a dish that I just cannot stand. I have never ordered a taco salad in my life and I wasn't about to start on this day. So that's what it takes.
Something really bad. I've had a few recent experiences at a major grocery chain where I'd get a rotisserie chicken or, you know, something like that. And I'd get it home and it'd still be raw or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't eat it, but I'd go right back and I'd give them, they don't ask, oh, no, sorry about that. No,
I've returned.
Kind of shits on your evening, but.
Yeah, it sucks when you already didn't have time to make dinner. That's why you were buying the rotisserie chicken in the first place.
It happens.
I've brought back food to a grocery store once. I bought some oysters. Dee and I were going to have like a Christmas dinner on Christmas Day. We both were randomly off. Like the restaurants that we both were working at just happened to not schedule us on Christmas. And neither of us hadn't been off together for Christmas for so long. We're not going to go to a restaurant because people that go to restaurants on Christmas are monsters. So instead, we just went to the grocery store and like loaded up on cool stuff. You know, got some oysters, got some steak for some steak tartare. Got some cheese and some fancy wine and some fancy beer. Just had like a picnic day. But the oysters that I got were like so old. When I got them home and like got them out of the bag and gave them a sniff, they were like ammoniated. And I popped one and the inside of it was bone dry. Like totally dry. So I went back to the grocery store and I was like, hey, do you have the, I'm not gonna say where I was. I was like, hey, you got the shellfish tags for those oysters? He's like, what's the problem? And I was like, these are super old. I kind of want to see the tags for them. And he's like, I don't know what you mean. And I was like, yes, you do. You have to hold them for 90 days. Every bag of live shellfish comes with a tag. He's like, I could replace the oysters. And I was like, I'm not here to replace oysters, man. I'm here to see some tags. And of course I was bluffing. I didn't care. I just wanted to let him know. And he was like, hey, man, look, I'll just give you 2 dozen of these oysters. They're fresh. They came in 2 days ago on the house. Won't worry about it. And I was like, that works. So I got,
he thought you were the law.
Well, I demonstrated a willingness to call somebody on. You don't sell somebody oysters that old. Come on.
Yeah. There's a fine line between profits and greed.
There was another time where I was at a different fancy pants gourmet store. I'll just give you a hint. It was not Go Cheap Cow. And they had a cheese counter and they had epois behind their cheese counter. And epois is my favorite cheese.
That's one of my faves too.
This epois was so old that it was dark brown. It smelled like cat pee through the plastic.
Yeah.
And you know how they come in those little wooden baskets that are the size of the wheel? This was like, shrunk in. You could almost get your pinky, all the way around where it was. Yeah. I just called the guy over and I was like, hey, bro, this epois is way, way, way past its prime. And he's like, looked fine to me. And I was like, okay.
All right, we're done here.
I was like, I'm honestly trying to help you. I'm in the cheese game. This is dead. And he's like, it's fine. And I was like, all right, never mind. You do you. Left, walked right out, never went back. And then the place closed.
Yep.
Like, if somebody is at your cheese counter and clearly demonstrates that, like, at no point was there any danger of me buying it. I was just trying to let the guy know, like, hey, man, maybe you don't know all about these 400 kinds of cheeses you got to deal with. This place hasn't been open that long. I'm not mad at you, but like, I'm here to help. Like, I was trying to let him know. So that pissed me off. But at restaurants, man, at restaurants, I turn into a big pussy.
I'm more sensitive about my kids than I am myself. Like if they order like we don't go out hardly ever, but if they get like, you know, the kitty Mac or something and it comes out and it's all broken puddle of grease and it's a ripping hot bowl or something, I might just, okay, don't eat that. Like I won't let them eat it and we'll just never go back.
Yeah.
Or like, for example, we were at a national restaurant chain the other day. My kids and my niece wanted to go out and I didn't want to go there, but I was all right, I'll go.
I made my parents go to some toe-up places when I was a kid.
This place was trashed. There was nobody there. Nobody were one girl there. I felt bad for her. She was the only server there. And it was just disgusting. And she sat us, and you could tell she was having a bad day. And the place was real busy, and she was the only person there. I was like, we got to go. We got up and left, and I never do that. Like, we're going to be sitting here for an hour and a half to get terrible food, and this is just the bad situation. Let's go. And honestly, I bet you she was thankful we left.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things
where you brought us some waters, and we're like, dude, this place is gross. It's bad. We got up and left. Yeah. And that's like the first time I can ever remember doing that.
Yeah, I will not usually get up and leave a restaurant. I mean, I can remember like one time Dee and I were on the road and she really wanted real food. We didn't know any of the places in town. We walked into a place and it was just clear from looking that it wasn't, that we weren't a place where we needed to be. It was just like, this is not what we wanted. But I mean, we didn't even sit down. We just took a look around and we were like, this ain't it. But that happens really rarely for me. And the thing is, like, I'll be choking down something I don't even like. And then, you know, so the server will come out and be, how is everything? And I'm always like, oh, it's great. Yeah. Like every time.
Yeah. And I ain't never coming back.
I mean, we were at, Dee and I were at a Michelin 2-star restaurant a couple weeks ago. And I'll go into this. This is part of my New York City travel log.
Okay.
And honestly, the meal was awesome. There was one plate, wasn't super good. And it was just kind of funny because it was like, that white asparagus thing, it's a little whack. I was like, yeah, it's not amazing. The server coming up, how is everything? I'm like, dude, fucking perfect, man. We're having such a great time. I think we were having a great time. It was just one course wasn't as good as everything else on the plate. But like, it was just funny because Dee and I were love, like, yeah, this one just didn't really come together. Like, we weren't pissed. I mean, we're super critical. We died out. We weren't mad or anything, but it was just kind of funny. It was kind of funny we were like, this is, you win a few, you lose a few. This was not the best thing we had. Guy comes up, how is everything? Like, oh, Soignier, dude, perfect, amazing. And he walked away. I was like,
I think it's really important when you go out to eat. You got to take into a lot of other factors, like A, who you're with. Like, if you're with children or elderly people or whatever, you got to take that in consideration, and you got to take into consideration what your expectations are. Like, don't have too high of temper your expectations, and you know, just look for food safety, like things like that. Like, avoid, like, you know, the olive oil with the garlic and herbs on the table. Yeah. Like, don't do that.
It was funny because even though we were at a 2-star, we still like, my expectation is not that every single thing we get over the course of a meal be absolutely perfect. Like, the thing is, what was I going to do? Cause somebody some stress? Be like, I don't know, this one just didn't do it for me. Like, people that are like that, man, I got no love in my heart for them. Like, it's one thing.
They are lonely, attention starved people who just want attention, usually. Sometimes there's a legitimate complaint and they usually feel just as bad as you do for even saying something.
Yeah, we got, the thing is, it's like, on the
and
one
then
hand,
I feel even worse.
if there's really a problem, if they really need to know, I'll tell them. If it's something that they need to know about. But apart from that, like, we had, between us, we had three courses each, plus like it was a four course prefix, plus a few extra plates and a few, like, you know, mignardise, amuse-bouche, all that stuff, all the bells and whistles. One thing we got wasn't totally awesome. Great. That was a badass meal. Like, it doesn't have to be, my standard isn't that every single thing be explosively amazing, but you get people who just want to critique and they don't, like, some people don't feel like they've, you know, really had a part of the process. It had their part in the process unless they've picked something apart. I kind of blame Top Chef. Did you notice this got worse after Top Chef became a thing?
I mean, I'm sure it has.
Like,
I know what you mean.
I don't know if I mean, this may be anecdotal because I think maybe it's just that I sort of got to the management level, like, while Top Chef was ascendant, but like the number of people that liked going, I mean, Top Chef caused a lot of Americans who weren't super into high-end food to be a lot more adventurous when they were going out. they'd be willing to go to nicer restaurants. They were seeing all this stuff on their primetime show. I mean, that show was a hell of a hit. I mean, it was just a like for a Bravo reality show.
I mean, I think it's still on.
It was at the time it had massive crossover. Oh,
when it first came out, like I watched the first couple seasons.
Massive crossover appeal. And
then it got around to like 6, 7. I lost.
I stopped watching for sure. I mean,
the first 2 or 3 seasons, they were cool.
It was a cool show, but I noticed that after, yes, a lot of diners liked to go out, but it also sort of turned into a lot of diners liking to be like the judges on Top Chef. And I don't know, maybe it's my imagination, but listeners, anybody notice that? Guys in the business, did diners start getting more nitpicky after Top Chef?
I don't know, but you know, I think it. Like, I don't really have any hard and fast rules with sending anything back. And I don't expect anyone to have as low of standards as I do. Or like, you know, just, you know, if it's dangerous, only if it's dangerous.
Yeah, like what John said, what Huff said, like, was.
I get it, man. You're paying good money for that cheeseburger. And if you ordered it medium and it's hammered.
Yeah, okay. That's what's funny. When I'm the one cooking, I want everyone to send everything back. I'm like, it's so funny because I'm such a pussy. I'm such a pussy when it's me in the dining room. I'm like, no, it's good. It's good. Mm-hmm. I like it. And then, if I'm in the kitchen, I'm like, hell yeah, send it back. Absolutely.
If you're paying $56 for a freaking 8-ounce filet and you ordered it medium rare and it's mid well, like.
Or if your chicken,
you know,
or if your $5 chicken fingers are cold. I mean, like,
hammered.
The chicken finger thing, that's an easy fix. Oh, I'm sorry, they sat in the window a minute. I'll either fry you some freshies or I'll just crisp these up. Either way, it's going to take 2 seconds. But when it's me sitting in the dining room, I'm the opposite, man. And I think that's kind of what Huff was getting at. I think Huff was sort of, because he said he would have to be worried he was going to get sick to send something back. I think it's funny how people like us, people in the business, are just like, I'll eat it, it's fine.
Yeah, cooks are the easiest people on earth to please. Like, they really are. Like, people get nervous. Like, I'm so nervous. Like, I don't want to cook for you. I'm like, dude, I do not care. Do I have to do anything? Oh, no. Then I'm fine.
Yeah. No, it's great.
Awesome. I don't care.
You know, I was
I'll eat it.
I was at this one. It was like a national chain. No, it wasn't a chain restaurant. It was like a restaurant that had one. There was one in Chicago. There was one in New York. There were probably a couple other large cities. A national group. I won't say the name because I'm about to rip them into them pretty hard. The food in general was pretty bad. Like, we ordered a lot of interesting stuff, and it just didn't come together well. Like for instance, they did a quail stuffed with a fig. And the fig was just a dry fig, not soaked or anything, just a dry fig stuck in the cavity of a quail. So it's like, what's that supposed to do? Like, it was just a hot, shriveled, dry fig. It didn't really soak
it's
up.
It's not going to soak up any of the quail juices. Right. It's not going to keep the quail moist.
It was just a hot fig. So it was already not a great meal. They were clearly like, if you had taken that fig and like soaked it in some, flame off some marsala with some shallots and soak the fig in that and then stuff that inside the quail, that would have done something. But, you know, it was a whack meal and that wasn't a problem. But there was one dish that was like a crispy fried chicken liver in a broth, like chicken liver on a piece of toast in a brodo. And I was like, that sounds nice. We ordered it and the chicken liver didn't have any
soggy.
It didn't, like, the breading didn't stick. So it was just like this gray.
Crispy and broth.
Well, that wasn't the problem. It was sitting out of the broth. So the composition would have worked, but the liver was fried so badly. It was just kind of, a gray, veiny, squishy chicken liver that was not crispy, but still overcooked. And, we didn't eat
it. Chalky.
It's kind of squishy. Like, you could poke it and it was cooked at a high enough heat to cook the life right out of it, but not a high enough heat to get any texture on the outside. And, so the server comes up and he's like, do you want me to see if they'll cook that in a little more? And I was like, nah, man, it's fine. And he goes, I was like, you can take it. He goes, all right. Now they still charged us for it, which I wouldn't have done because he knew it sucked. And
see, they should pick up on stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like I'll send some visual cues like, oh, are you finished with that?
Like, we didn't eat it. He asked if I wanted it. He asked if I wanted it cooked a little more, and I'm like, that's not the issue here. Like, it wasn't under, it just sucked. But even then, I didn't say anything. I figured.
I won't say anything. Okay, charge me. I ordered it. Fair enough.
Yeah, and I learned, and I have never, ever, ever gone back to that restaurant.
Right, and I've been on lame carnival rides and stuff I've gotten ripped off plenty of other times. You ain't the first.
Yeah. One time I tried to buy drugs on Bourbon Street. That doesn't work, by the way. Don't ever try to buy drugs on Bourbon Street.
Would you get a bag of oregano?
They'll take your money. I was 23 or something, man. I was to be an idiot again. All right. Well, John Huff, I hope that answers your question. It turns out we're just like you. It's pretty rare for us to send anything back or complain ever. But later on, when we're sitting around with our buddies, scorched fucking earth. Yeah, that place sucks.
Yeah. I mean, and if you are, if there is any listeners out there, you know, like, don't feel like you can't. Just be right.
Yeah.
Have something to back up your argument a little bit, you know, like, yeah,
my advice to the civilians is,
yes,
if you really don't like something, don't eat it. If you really don't like it and you think it was made incorrectly, feel free to say something, because a lot of times the chef will know full well that something's gone wrong, but like, it had to go out because of timing. They're like, oh, that's going to come back. You ever done that? You ever sent something out and thought that's going to come back?
Yeah.
I'm not proud. But I've done it.
No, I've done it.
I think
you're screwed. And you know, it's like, let's try it.
We've all done it. We've all done it. I was like, well, definitely missed that temp. I cannot have this table waiting any longer. It's happened. It's happened where you send out something borderline and you want to kill yourself. And then have you ever had one where it came back and you were kind of glad it came back?
Yeah, for sure.
Because then you just eat some crow, you get a new
one.
Or
like the chef's hounding you and you're like, I need that, I need that, I need that. Chef, 3 more minutes. I need it now. I need 3 minutes. I need it. Okay, here you go. And then it comes back and you're like.
Yeah. I mean, I worked at one place that will also remain nameless, but if anybody's listened to this or knows me at all, it's pretty much my least favorite job ever. You've already mentioned it before. where if we had something that wasn't up to snuff, we knew that getting it into the dining room was the best way to get it out of our lives. Because this place was so big that a lot of times when something needed to be refired, the server wouldn't take it back and show the chef. They just order another one.
Yeah.
And then comp it off later. Because this place was so huge that stuff like that could get lost in the shuffle. So it was easier to send out something you knew was bad, because if the chef saw it, he'd like ream you he'd go out of his way to make sure that, you know, everyone saw you getting ripped apart. If you could get into the dining room, then it would be on the server to fix it. And he'd just order another one. And then it would get comped at the end of the night. By that time, you're long gone. And, I 100% hold that chef responsible for this culture. That's actually, he is the reason why I've always been like, don't yell at people who come to you with a problem.
Yeah.
Let them know you're here to fix it. If they have something they're not behind, you cannot have them be afraid to let you know that, because your cooks will figure out ways to do the dirty, and you'll never see that plate again, because it'll be in the dining room under a cloche. And
you're absolutely right. But you know, like, any reputable place will handle it properly right away. Like, and you know, taste is subjective, quality is not. So if it's a taste thing, it could be subjective, but you could say something for sure. But if it's a quality issue, they'll take care of it.
If something's undersalted, do not be afraid to ask for salt. Like, don't be afraid. If something's oversalted, that's tough, because salt palates can be subjective. If something's really too salty for you to eat, you might want to get it to be refired, but that one's going to annoy the chef, because some people have pretty strange salt palates. But if something's undersalted, it's no problem for them to bring you more salt. No problem at all. And honestly, if a server comes back and says, chef, I've had 4 tables say they want salt on their fish, then the chef's going to be like, hey, fish guy, start salting your food. And the whole restaurant gets better. The whole restaurant gets better with something like that.
Yep.
But I would say that also, though, On the other hand, don't be afraid to say something if you really think there's a problem or if you really, really, really didn't like something. Having said that, when a server comes around for a checkback, that checkback is not the time to say, I don't know, this dish didn't really do it for me. That checkback is to say, this was wrong and needs to be redone. Just deciding that, you know, this just wasn't as good as I thought it'd be. That's not a complaint. If that happens, you don't send something back for that. You just quietly file it. You think, okay, well, that just like the one dish that was off at the Michelin 2-star restaurant. I put that meal down as probably one of the top 10 of my life. Like on the whole, it was very much a win. So what would the point have been for me to say that one dish didn't do it for me? I just quietly thought, well, that one wasn't a winner. And and then I moved on and there were a bunch more winners after that. If the server comes back for a checkback, he is giving you the opportunity to say, this wasn't cooked to temp. This is not what I ordered. Is this supposed to be this cold? There's a hair. There's a piece of like steel wool from a dishwasher scrubby. That's what that's for. It's not for being a judge from Top Chef and picking things apart. If you do that, you're a complete prick.
Oh, absolutely. That's well said, buddy.
Well, I think we've hammered that topic pretty well. You got anything else to add?
No, that's about it, man.
John Huff, man. Good on you, brother. Really, really good question. I'll tell you what, I'll say this. I don't think I've ever been worried that something was going to make me sick.
Once or twice, like very, very few times. Like
it's been a more of a concern lately.
Rare poultry or like...
Because of my wife's recent situation where she almost died from food poisoning, she is now focused on getting stuff. Like she'll get her ground stuff well done. She doesn't do like rare burger or medium rare pink any ground meat anymore, and she's a little weird about tartare and carpaccio. Like the last time she had a carpaccio, I made it, and I actually went it was the lamb carpaccio from the blog Hot Dogs and Caviar at blogspot.com. It was that lamb leg carpaccio, and I went to the trouble of freezing all the roulades and then searing the hell out of them, so there was no surface microbe. And like if I was going to make her a tartare, I'd get a whole Chateaubriand and like half freeze it and then sear the outside, cut the seared parts off, and then let it sit and thaw again, and then make it from that. Because, you know, she legit almost died, and she didn't necessarily get this from raw meat. In fact, she lives pescavegan most of the time, but that is something that we're a little more squeamish about. So she'll be a little more careful, but I don't care. I'll eat anything, man. I'm not scared. Like, it's just like the most nastiest, like gross stepped on burrito from the worst fucking burrito truck in the world. I'm just like, it's probably all right. Like, and, you know, the thing is like I got a wife who is, you know, infirm, she's got her health issues. And then you got kids. So I understand that's a whole different thing. So, but for me,
I'll eat pretty much anything too.
I can't think of anything that I thought was going to make me sick. I
can't really either. Just those couple rotisserie chickens I've seen.
Right.
I was like, ooh, I don't know.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the raw chicken, a healthy adult, probably not going to kill you. It'll just make you wish you were dead. Yeah. Like, E. coli, I can't remember the name of the strain. It's like H10157 or something like that. That's a real killer. That will absolutely kill you if you don't catch it. Salmonella, just make your guts rotten, make you the most miserable person on earth. But
it'll just make you wish you were dead.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you said you had a side topic for you as well. While we've once again, Tarver King couldn't make it because of something. Who knows? He's a busy guy. So we're holding off my description of our D and my amazing New York travelogue until we can get Tarver here, just because there's some dishes I want to tell him about and like listen to his mind get blown. Really, we had some great stuff. But so that's some cool topics, but that's once again put off. And so we're just goofing around on some fun side topics. Nate, what was your other topic? You told me, but I forgot because I'm stupid.
It's mildly interesting. I made a pop-up pizza oven.
Oh, cool.
It was inspired by Chef Steps and YouTube University.
Is YouTube University a thing, or is that just what you're calling learn how to make stuff on YouTube?
That's what I call YouTube.
Got it. That's I mean, that's how I learned to edit. That's how I learned to edit podcasts.
But yeah, it was pretty cool. And they got some cool blueprints on chef steps, and it even looks like they made it so it looks like Lego instructions. It's really kind of cool.
That's pretty awesome.
I built it with the kids. I went to a big box hardware store, if you will, bought some bricks and pavers and kind of stacked it up. It's more like a deck oven. I didn't order it in or anything.
You for real built a brick oven. This is awesome.
Yeah. And then I put a fire. I made a few modifications because I'm me. Bought a couple pieces of rebar and pavers. It worked out pretty good though, man. It got real hot. It baked a nice pizza. I think the next time that we put the pizza oven back together, I'm going to put a fire on the top of it too, because the top stone didn't really get hot enough to get that. So you could dome it.
Cool.
But the bottom, we got beautiful leoparding and nice wood flavor. They cooked in about 3 minutes. So it was fun. The kids had fun. They thought it was awesome. Hopefully they remember someday, but
I still have a substantial quantity of semi-legal fireworks that I got at south of the border. So yes. I still need to come up there and blow up part of America with your kids.
Yeah.
You want to fire up the wood oven for that?
Yep. Let's do it.
That'd be fun. That'd be a good excuse to do it. And I'll be there and we'll
have a pizza and firework party.
Yeah. I mean, fire in general, just us lighting things on fire, whether it's, that sounds like fun.
Fire
rules. I mean,
it was fun. I'll post some pictures. I'll share some pictures. It wasn't very high off the ground either. I think I'll get some more cinder blocks next time, so I don't have to lay down. And
so you disassembled it when it was done?
Yeah, a couple of days later.
Just
Alex, aka Trinidad Scorpion, was being a wiener that day, so I made him carry bricks across the yard.
Character building exercise, just like a dad.
I want you to move all those bricks and put them in a pile. All right. No, he did a good job.
I've read two books on how to do a brick oven. One was one you got me. I remember like many years ago.
I still want to build one. I've never, but
you just asked me like what I wanted to learn, and I said I really want to learn to use a brick oven. You showed up like, I guess it was my birthday or something. You turned up like 2 weeks later with a book on how to build and run a brick oven. It was super cool. I don't really have a yard where I could actually legally do that, but it was still really good. And then I got social like a year later. And so I learned how to use a brick oven very well. Like I used one all day, every day for like 5 years of my life.
I think I have that same book, and I joined like a brick oven, like builder group on like Facebook, and look, watching them how to make like the Pompeii ovens and the domed ones.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks super cool. And I was asking my buddy, who's super handy, and I go, how hard is it to do that masonry? And like, it's incredibly difficult. I was like, oh.
I thought you were going to say,
he goes, it's really, really freaking hard. I was like,
well, the other
worked with masonry before? No, sir.
Dude, don't. I can't even change my own oil.
Yeah. Like,
the handiest
it
thing
looks I so cool though
the handiest thing I can do I can rewire a guitar. That is like that's, I can change
I a light. Stack bricks like Legos and put a fire on the bottom.
I can change a light. I could change a bad light switch or a bad outlet. I can do that.
There you go.
And I can rewire a guitar. I know how to use a soldering iron. It's the only tool I'm actually like proficient with. That's all I can fix. I know how to countersink a screw into FRP. I could do that, because the guy that was putting up new FRP in our kitchen is like, hey, make yourself useful, do this a bunch of times. And I was like, I could use the power drill
for real.
No, I'm so not handy that one year for Christmas my dad got my wife a power drill. And she just opens it up and she's like, all right. And I was like, oh, God damn it. Like, my dad gets my wife a power drill and my mom got me a whole bunch of little ramekin shaped like seashells from fucking Crate and Barrel. Oh, My mom was sort of perturbed when I went into restaurant work initially, but then when she realized that it was a chance for her to get all of my birthday gifts for the rest of time at Crate and Barrel, she couldn't have been happier. She was like, oh, I get him cute little ramekins. That's just all I have. I have a cupboard so full of cute little ramekins.
That's awesome. Still
in the package. I could not. No one has that many cocktail parties.
You could have a fondue pot.
I at one point had two fondue pots. I think we might be down to zero. We might have actually gotten rid of the fondue pot. But the thing about a fondue pot is you just do fondue in a pot. Like the whole idea of the fondue kit is,
it's, yeah, I know, right?
If you have a well-appointed kitchen, you don't need a fondue set. You can just do it with formal tools. That's what they don't tell you about the fondue pot is that it's just.
You totally don't need this.
Yeah. Well, Dee and I did not register for a fondue set, but got not one, but two fondue sets as a wedding present. I was like, you guys, I've never had fondue in my life. we had a really, really good fondue party. We had some friends over and we had a bunch of wine and we started making some fondue. One thing led to another. And the next thing you know, we're all at this gay bar disco called The Circuit and D was dancing in a cage with a Mexican kid with no shirt on, and that's how my fondue party ended up.
Wow. I bet you they don't happen like that in the Netherlands.
I think the average age at that party was like 20-21. Like, I was like the elder statesman of that group. I was 24 and I was the oldest by a good bit. I think my friend Tim's wife was 25. I think she was the grand dame. that was a good time. Well, the other book that I got really good instruction on how to build a wood oven out of is, you know, the River Cottage handbooks. Have you got any of those?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I got three or four of them.
You have the bread one?
Yep.
The bread one has a whole chapter on how to build a brick oven. And it's honestly, I mean, it's Hugh Friendly Whittingstall, so he kind of makes you feel like you could do anything. Like, you read his books, and he's just, like, such a great teacher and such a great writer. Everyone should read Hugh Friendly Whittingstall's cookbooks. First, get meat. It's the best book on meat cooking, meat philosophy, all that. But then he also has those little handbooks. Man, they're a little pricey because they're out of print, and they're in the UK, so they're kind of hard to find. But I have never gotten one of those and been disappointed by it.
Oh, yeah, I got three or four of them. They're really cool.
Yeah, I collect them like baseball cards. I don't have that many yet, but I have a few. The bread one was great. The mushrooms one was great.
The mushrooms, the preserves. I
mean, the mushroom one was kind of scary because it was just like talking about, you know.
Like, I didn't go like foraging out of that book.
Also, Britain and the U.S. have different like fauna. Uh-huh. So or a different flora, rather. So it was like, it was different mushrooms. And I was like, this isn't useless to me, but it was really cool.
It was cool though. Yeah.
I've bought mushrooms from mushroom foragers, like from a non-licensed mushroom foragers before. I won't say which restaurant I bought them at, but you probably worked there. there were a couple of guys that would bring us chanterelles.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was something sort of at least somewhat not entirely legal about that whole thing. But the two people that I was buying from, I trusted. I don't know if I trust myself. I would absolutely, like, I can't do it. I'm just too nervous. I would be so worried that I accidentally poisoned somebody.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But those books are great. Their bread book, first off,
that's the best one.
Oh God, it's got some great recipes. I mean, I just made classic bread, and like the cool thing about the bread recipe is it was like 60 pages long, and it presented it like it was a formula. It's like, here's how you make bread. Here's all the different
every
things.
Every step, very meticulous.
But also every step full of options. It's like, you want to make whole grain seed bread? Mm-hmm. Do this and this and this. Like, it was one, it was one recipe.
Yep. Choose your own adventure.
And he specifically said, like, your first few batches are going to suck. Yep. Like, bread baking is not like, it's not like cooking. It's a process that you have to learn from the ground up, and it's not going to be easy. It's such a good book on bread baking. My only regret is that I didn't have more time to put into it, because I'm not a baker. Like, bread baking is its own thing. It's kind of
been all about it lately. I just can't stop thinking about it. I love it.
How's your bread looking?
pretty good.
Oh, how's your?
I'm doing bread and pizza.
Oh, what's your Einkorn starter's name?
Oh, Ray Finkel.
How's Ray Finkel doing?
Good. He's dormant right now. I got tired of feeding him every day.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't baking that much with him. It's pretty good. I like it. It's funky. You can get him super funky.
You know, I'm glad. The thing about her Hugh Friendly Whittingstall's book that really I really enjoyed was that after the chapter that's basically just one recipe for bread and all the different things you can do with it, the next chapter was on recipes that use old bread. That's so key. Because like the thing about bread is if you make it and it's not perfect, you worked really hard on it. You can't throw it away. Like my loaves looked great. They smelled great. The flavor was perfect. They were just a little dense. I think I let them proof a little too long. And so they got a little overpoofed to where the gluten structure couldn't hold it. And then when I baked them, they just didn't puff the way they should have because I overdid the gluten on the proof. I think, yeah. Man, I'm not 100% sure. But I had all these loaves of bread that I just poured my heart into and they were kind of like too dense to use. But the whole chapter on what to do with day old bread, this bread was day old the minute it was out of the oven. So
old bread, old stale bread is gold, man.
I made a dish called summer pudding and it was so simple. All you did, you took like a bowl, like a steel, it didn't have to be steel. I used a steel bowl because that's what I got. And you line it with slices of old bread. And then you make just a ton of macerated berries, like blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, all that stuff piled in with all this, all sorts of sugar, maybe scrape a vanilla bean, splash of booze, whatever. And then, so you have a bowl lined with bread, you pack some of the wet fruit in there, and then a layer of, that's fine. You pack some of the wet fruit in there and then a layer of bread and then another layer of wet fruit and then another layer of bread to sort of fill the bottom. And then you put a stack of plates on it to weight it and you just let it sit in the fridge for like 24 hours. And during the 24 hours, the all of the berry juice just soaks into the bread. And then you can turn it out. And then you turn it out and you got this thing you can slice like a cake that's made entirely of bread and fruit. And it just like takes your old bread. It's almost like it's not bakeless. You bake the bread, but like, you don't have to rebake it. It was like a bread pudding, but totally fruit-based. I mean, you could have done it vegan. I mean, it was better with a big scoop of ice cream on it, so I can't get behind the vegan thing. But man, that book gave you such a great group of strategies for using up the crappy bread that you produce. I've never seen a bread recipe book do that before, where he was like, you know, you're probably going to be producing some loaves that aren't 100%. Here's an entire chapter of stuff to do with them. I'm just like, thank you, sir. You're one of the good ones.
He is one of the good ones. Kill It, Cook It, Eat It.
Haven't seen any of his shows. I've seen a clip of him on YouTube. I've heard him talk, but I've never actually sat down to one of his shows. I love his books so much.
Pretty dry, but they're cool.
I mean, I got a pretty good tolerance for boring, man.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, I got to tell you about the book I'm reading. It is called Signature Dishes That Matter. Have you heard of it?
Mm-mm.
It's out. It's on a Fight On, the publishers. It's Fight On, and it's really really cool. It goes back in time. But basically, they got a panel of chef editors, like editors, cookbook writers, food writers, chefs, a pretty good panel, and they voted on what they thought the most important signature dishes were of the last like of all cuisine up till now. So the first one in there is gelato. And basically like in 1648, this guy invented a gelato machine. And before that, gelato was super expensive because you had to go up a mountain to get snow and then bring it down when it was still cold and mix it with like honey and fruit puree. And it was a rich people thing only because there was no way to keep it cold. But in 1648, this dude figured out how to take ice and make a chiller. And he made it so that anyone could come to his shop and pay, I don't know, a couple of lire. I don't know how Italian currency works, but like come to a shop and anyone could have this dessert that used to be for like royalty only. And that's as far back as you're going. And then, so I'm reading it. And then there's recipes for a lot of them. Like the one that I just read was like 1980 Wolfgang Puck's smoked salmon pizza with caviar.
Yeah.
I've had it. It's a nice dish. It's not super special, but then it's super cool. Like, they do, I mean, there's a whole section on Le Gargouillou, mm-hmm. Le Gargouillou, mm-hmm. that it just reprints the recipe out of the Michelle Bra book. Same thing with the chocolate coulant. They do those two recipes for brat. So they go, they're going from like, but then there's another chapter on the Big Mac. Like they're covering signature dishes cool. all levels. Apparently the Big Mac, there was this McDonald's franchisee and he's like, hey, corporate, I need a double burger. People want a bigger sandwich. You got to come up with a double burger. And McDonald's corporate was dragging their feet. So this guy's like, screw you guys, I'll make a double burger. And he put together what became the Big Mac. And he put it on his menu and he's like, hey, corporate, it's selling. And corporate's like, yeah, we're doing that. And, you know, one of the most famous hamburgers in America was born just of diners wanting something extra.
Cool. Oh, man.
So it's a super cool book. I'm learning so much. It's a little frustrating. And I'll write up a whole review on the blog. It's a little frustrating because the recipes don't always match the article written about the dish. Like, at one point, it's like, you know, it talked about Marchese's saffron risotto with the gold leaf saffron risotto.
Right.
And it talked about how it was, you know, cooked with a mixture of beef and chicken stock. And then when you look at the recipe, it only calls for chicken stock. And it's like, what is it, dude? Like, you know, just the recipes don't always match the words. And it's like this, a little bit of editing would have made this a lot stronger. But it's a fascinating, fascinating book. I recommend it to any student of cuisine. And this is, I'm only halfway through, but I'm having a great time with it. Just an absolutely great time.
Cool, man. That's exciting.
I mean, they cover up to pretty recent stuff, like 2016. Like one of the last recipes that's in there is off the top of my head, the cronut.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because the cronut, man, you got to admit, that's a signature dish. That got hot. Mm-hmm. And the cat was smart enough to trademark the name. So no one else,
Ansel?
I can't remember the guy's name.
Ansel, I think.
That sounds right. I mean, I'll put a link to his, you know, bio on the blog or something just to make sure, because I feel bad for not remembering his name off the top of my head. Although you're almost certainly correct. You're never wrong about shit like this. But for those of you who have not heard of this, this French pastry chef in New York City had an idea where you make take croissant dough and fry it like a donut. Or do they fry it or do they bake it? I haven't gotten to that part yet.
I'm not sure.
But like basically, they make a donut with croissant dough. He called it a cronut and it got hot. And I think you could probably argue that that was one of the main foods that was kind of put on blast by Instagram. Like social media had a role in that. As much as I dislike social media with every fiber of my being, come check us out on blogspot.com, hotdogsandcaviar.blogspot.com. keep an eye on Nate's Instagram. It's been a fascinating read. This it's interesting to see like something as simple as the Big Mac, or as played out as the smoked salmon pizza, or like the club sandwich. Like somewhere had to be the first place to do a club sandwich. It's super cool read. It's kind of expensive for what it is. It's like a $50 book, but honestly, I would get this as a Christmas gift for any culinary student, assuming that there are still such thing as culinary students. I'm almost kind of curious about that. But young cook, it's just a fun book. Phaidon makes good books.
That is a great publisher. Everything they do, like they're like Dorling Kindersley of like single subject things.
Yeah, I mean they did
encyclopedias. They did great stuff.
Cucchiaio d'Argento, the Silver Spoon, that sort of encyclopedic Italian cookbook from like the 70s.
Yep.
They did something similar for Greek cuisine. They did 1,058 recipes, I think it was called. That was all the old school Spanish food. Like, if you've got a young cook on your Christmas list, not that it's anywhere near Christmas, but by the time I get this edited, it probably will be. If you've got a young cook on your Christmas list, Phaidon, Phaidon, like they really make some great.
Their books. Whole catalog is solid, mostly Euro guys, but still,
yeah,
solid. There's a few Americans, but.
And the cool thing about this book is that the signature dishes that matter is that it's global. Like, you know, there's dishes like they cover Japanese dishes. They cover Chinese dishes, Indian dishes. There is more attention paid to Michelin star stuff than there is to other stuff. Like there's
That's obviously their bread and butter.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, certain chefs don't even get one, and then Michel Braun gets two. You know, the Paul Bocuse gets two. They do his truffle soup and the potato scaled rouge. But on the other hand, if I had to pick between those two, which one was Bocuse's signature dish, I don't know what I'd do. You know, they're both super important. But like, even though they give a little bit more airtime to the French dudes, they do a really good job of really trying their best to make sure it stays global. Including some stuff, it's like, there was one dish where it's always fun when you like you read a dish in Chinese in translation. The dish was called like husband and wife lung slices. And I was like, I know without looking that that's a Chinese dish, because you could always tell with Chinese dish names that it doesn't translate very well, because their entire language is just fundamentally structurally different from the way that like Western languages are put together. So they have a certain amount of poeticness that comes from the individual characters used, but it makes things seem really, really weird in translation. Like if you go with a literal translation, it's always kind of strange. Like Mapo tofu, which is my favorite Chinese dish. Have you had it?
No.
Oh, you'd like it. It's a Sichuan dish. It's basically just chunks of tofu, and they're so delicate. I don't know how they keep them together. Somehow they stop it from getting scrambled. They like poach them in chicken stock, and then they serve them up in this greasy red meat sauce that's like ground pork and doubanzhang, which is like garlic fermented soybean paste, and hot chili oil and dried like spicy ass hot peppers and Szechuan pepper. And you just like, it has you like crying when you take a bite. Your face is numb and electric and on fire. You're sweating bullets. And like, yeah, it's tofu, but it's in the porkiest, greasiest sauce ever. So there's nothing diet about it. It's absolutely delicious. The one they have at Xiaobao Biscuit is really, really good. It's less greasy than it used to be, and I'm gonna say that's kind of a knock. The recipe, and Lucky Peach put out a recipe that is fire.
And so it's probably
in one of their cookbooks at some point, but it's like the recipe from Han Dynasty, which is a Chinese place in New York City. I learned to make it at home. I can't keep the chunks of tofu nice. It always looks like scrambled brains. I don't know how they do it. It's just magic. I don't know how they get this like this tofu that's like, it's not firm tofu, it's like delicate silken tofu. It's silken tofu, and they managed to make the dice hold together. And every time I make it, it's like scrambled brains. It still tastes great, but it always looks bad. And you know, I kind of like that I haven't figured it out yet. But what I was coming around to was that Mapo tofu in Chinese literally means old pockmarked faced woman tofu. Which,
wow.
And there's just like all good dish stories, there's a couple of stories of how it got that name. One story is just that they were like, this came out in like the 1800s, like a very, very old dish. I don't remember the exact year. I'll put something about it on the blog. So story number one was just that the woman that owned the restaurant that had the tofu just had smallpox scars. So they were just like, yeah, old pock face over there. She makes some good tofu. The other story is that when the tofu sits, like the white tofu sits in the bumpy, crumbly, greasy meat sauce and then kind of rolls over, the surface of the tofu looks like it's got smallpox scars on it. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's a delicious dish with a crazy name. This one thing this book does well is it really does seem to, if there's a couple of different stories of how it just got its name or where it just came from, it goes ahead and tells you all the stories. And it's like, you know, these are the different competing theories. This is the one we're putting our money behind, but who knows?
It's a lot like food history is a lot of that. It's like majority rules.
Yeah. I mean, like if you go to Antoine's in New Orleans, they'll put right next to the baked Alaska that they invented baked Alaska. They do the same thing with souffle potatoes. They invented neither of those things, but they're like our creation. And they're like, we've been open since 1867. What are you going to do? Disagree with us? Yeah. The one thing that was invented at Antoine's for real is oysters Rockefeller.
Yeah. But usually the consensus is usually what I go with.
but even so, like you can get sometimes the consensus is nonsense. Like,
oh, absolutely. And sometimes the myth outweighs the actual facts, and it'll never change.
You know, and let's close with this. Let's close with this one. Guys, anyone that is a professional cook at home, sorbet versus sherbet. What's the difference? Now, I know a lot of times they teach you that sorbet is non-dairy, whereas sherbet has dairy in it. But I think that's bullshit. Because like that cheap sherbet, you know, that like the Tana sherbet that came, the 80s sherbet that came in like
three colors.
Yeah, that shitty rainbow
pastel
sherbet. That was always dairy free. That was like just basically like
ice pop, crystals.
They just took they took whatever popsicles were made of and poured them into an ice cream freezer and you know, like oversweetened Kool-Aid and then
spun them terribly.
And spun them terribly. I kind of like that stuff, man. But like I say that sorbet and sherbet are the same word. And the Italian sorbetto, they're all corruptions of the Arabic sharbat, which is an old school dessert. And actually, it's similar to the first gelato. It was a dessert where they take snow and they cover it with fruit puree and honey and eat with a spoon. So I think sorbet and sherbet are the same thing. And when people try to convince me that one has dairy and the other one doesn't, I just want to punch them in the face. Like, think critically. Somebody said that to someone somewhere along the way. And along the way, everybody decided that was true.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not. It's obviously not. It's so clearly a cognate. It's a similar word. It's kind of like how somebody decided that like searing the meat was sealing in the juices. And you still hear that.
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I went to cooking school in like 2000, which you'd think would be enlightened times. And the instructor was showing us a video that the CIA had put out a few years before, and they still talked about sealing in the juices. And he said, hey, guys, this isn't true. That doesn't really do it. And then Alton Brown proved it on Good Eats. You remember that one?
No.
Oh, he did an experiment. He took two pieces of meat and he seared one and then let it cool. Like they were both exactly, I don't know. I don't remember how big they were, like exactly 500 grams, like two pieces of meat that were to the gram, exactly the same size, seared one and then didn't sear the other and then baked them both. And he's like, by this logic, the one that was seared should retain more of its juices because they were sealed in. And then, of course, the one that was seared lost more of its weight because it had more heat applied. Mm-hmm. And searing doesn't do any sealing at all.
No.
Like, it's like the I think the logic was that you can cauterize a wound with heat. So, therefore, you can cauterize muscle tissue. But cauterization is about sealing blood vessels. It's not about sealing muscle tissue. It's like what the juice that's in meat isn't blood. It's not hemoglobin. It's myoglobin. It's an entirely
water. Yeah.
It's protein water, but it's a different kind of protein water than blood.
It's not blood. It is not blood. It is not blood. It is not blood.
Yeah. What's coming out of your steak is not blood. If there's blood coming out of your steak, then your cow wasn't bled properly. And I would like to have a word with the slaughterhouse that took care of that. Some culinary bullshit. Well, that was an interesting little twist and turn there.
Yeah, that was fun.
I think we got enough material for an episode of the Hot Dogs and Caviar.
Yeah, I got to get Trinidad to bed here.
Yeah, it's 10:03. He's going to turn into a gremlin.
Truth be told.
All right, well, Speakeasy's going to play us out of here. Thanks for listening. This is a fun little episode. And yeah, tune in for, I say next week, but we all know that's bullshit at this point. Sooner or later, we're going to get Tarver King to sit down with us and we're going to talk about my culinary adventures in New York City and just some of the great new foods that I discovered. I say that like I did anything. I paid some people to give me food and some people made some really, really great food and gave it to me. And I just want to take the boys through what I learned. So we'll see you soon for that. Until then.
Good.
I am the Mouth of the South for Nate Spincake Whiting. We'll see y'all next time.
See you later.